Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University in Australia, and I'm also currently a Danish Diabetes and Endocrine Academy visiting professor at the University of Copenhagen. The idea behind Inside Exercise is to bring to you the absolute world experts in exercise research. And what I want you to do is to get your information from the research experts rather than from influencers. Indeed, today I'm bringing to you Professor David Bishop from Victoria University in Melbourne, Australia. He's an expert on exercise physiology, but specifically on mitochondrial function and volume in response to exercise training. So here's some very interesting results that there can be a dissociation between mitochondrial function and mitochondrial volume with different types of training. So very high intensity training tends to increase the mitochondrial function more than the volume, while more prolonged sort of low intensity exercise increases the mitochondrial volume more than the mitochondrial function. So we talked about this, what are some of the potential mechanisms and how athletes can potentially use this to their advantage by doing a mixture of training. I found it very interesting. I think you will too, so stick around. Hi, David. Thanks for coming on to Inside Exercise. How are you doing?
No, really well, Glenn. And good to see you.
Yeah, it's funny to see you like this. So, some people probably know, so others wouldn't, but we both started off research leaders at Victoria University in the Institute for Sport, Exercise and Active Living. You were the sports research leader. I was the exercise research leader, Remco Polman, the active living. So, that was 2010. So we were hanging around a lot for quite a while there.
I can remember the AC/DC coming out of your office late at night. when we used to share it, we had before we went to the open plan office, we had our offices are right next to each other. So I think, after about 6 o'clock, AC/DC used to come out every now and again.
That's funny. That's before I got onto the Swedish doom metal.
Okay. Well, I'm pleased about that.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So it's great to have you on, and there's been a lot of, a lot of questions on Twitter, a lot of likes and retweets and all that. So that's great. So what I want to talk to you about is, the old, I don't know if it's an old chestnut, but, is it best to exercise, is it intensity or duration in terms of sort of mitochondrial function and volume and things like that? And this is a great follow-up. Well, I'm hoping it'll be a great follow-up. I'm sure it will be. On the podcast I have had Andy Coggan on saying, is there anything special about zone two? And which, spoiler alert, he says no. And then Stephen Siller with polarized training and all that. And even Michael Joyner talking about endurance training methods and saying things like all roads lead to Rome, so no matter what you do, you sort of end up the same point. I know you've had a look at a couple of those podcasts. So what do you think? And what do you think?
Yeah, great. And I know that, we were speaking off air, so I know that, I'm assuming there'll be some, exercise people as well as scientists and a mix of the two. So I think, one of the tricky things in the field, and you've touched on it before, is this all the different terminology out there. So that might be a good place to start. So and I know a lot of people do this and the way we do it. So normally what I'll do is I'll have the zone one, which is before the first metabolic threshold. Then zone two is between the first and the second metabolic threshold. And then zone three is above the second metabolic threshold. And I think you mentioned this on one of the early podcasts. I've seen up to seven zones. So, sometimes you go zone two, okay, that's zone four and this guy and zone three with this person, et cetera. So it's probably good to get that out of the way. And I think the other thing that'll be good just to dive into a little bit is that, most of my research is at the moment on mitochondrial adaptations to different types of training. So I've got some reasonably firm ideas on the best type of training to alter the mitochondria, but there's more to being an endurance athlete than just mitochondria. So I think I'd just add that caveat that I can, probably give some ideas on the best ways to develop your mitochondria, but that's not necessarily going to be the best way to develop endurance performance.
Exactly. And another thing is, you know, when we first talked about what are we going to call the topic, and I like the way you made it really simple, you know, is it intensity or volume? You know, I think I suggested, you know, oh, what's best, you know, for dot, dot, dot. And you said, well, it depends on, you know, where you're at, what you're training for, whatever. So do you want to just flesh that out a little bit? So if someone says to you, oh, what should I be doing? You know, intensity or duration, you know, just the things to consider, you know, like what stage, you know, what are you training for a start, for example?
Yeah. No, as I said, so I think the important thing is to know what we're talking about. And we're actually got a paper on that at the moment, that we're writing at the moment, is, like I said, make sure that we're on the same page when we're talking about intensity. And then exactly as you said, you know, it depends on what adaptations you're looking to get. What we've seen, and I think is maybe consistent with some of the literature out there and some of the other talks you had, is that the volume of training seems, and what I mean by volume is, I guess, the total exercise exposure. So it's a combination of intensity and duration. So to give maybe an example, like you could, you know, walk at 8 kilometers an hour. It's quite slow, but 8 kilometers an hour for 2 or 3 hours. And that would be the same volume as running at 16 kilometers per hour for an hour, so to speak. So the volume is the intensity times the duration. With respect to the mitochondria, so what we've seen is there seems to be that the volume of training is important to develop the mitochondrial content. So you can think about that by as in how much mitochondria you have. And what we've seen is a quite low, relatively low intensity, high volume, you get good adaptations in the mitochondrial content, and they probably they'll exceed the changes in the mitochondrial function. And so when I'm saying function, I'm talking about the ability of the mitochondria to take substrates and oxygen and to produce ATP or energy. And then at the other extreme, so if you have very high intensity, so talking about, you know, like classic sprint interval training, 30 seconds all out, that seems to be really effective at developing the mitochondrial function, but less effective at developing mitochondrial content. And in the middle, so between the two metabolic thresholds, and classically a lot of high intensity interval training, or in between the two thresholds, what we find that we get a little bit of a mix there is that there's a combination of increasing in the mitochondrial content and also an increase in the mitochondrial function.
Oh, well, that's interesting. I guess I didn't quite realize that. So, you know, I had Marty Gabala on, and I'm not sure if we talked much about function. I guess we talked more about content. But, you know, the idea was, you know, if you did the high-intensity intermittent training, so the HIIT training, compared to the the classic sort of studies, HIIT versus continuous, it seemed like you got similar increases in like citrate synthase, which, you know, is a marker of mitochondrial volume. But I guess we didn't really think that much about function. And that's interesting that you get this dissociation. I somehow missed that. So you're saying with those sprint interval training, so they're really full on, like, you know, the sprint end of the HIIT, so, you know, really short stuff, you're actually getting greater increases in mitochondrial function, but not necessarily volume. And then with the lower intensity, you're getting more volume, but not necessarily as much of an increase in function. Now, how does that work? Because I guess I'm a bit, as you know, I did some mitochondrial function stuff. We even did some together.
Yeah.
I guess I was always a little bit on the periphery there. I was tending to think they were sort of going hand in hand, and I guess they kind of did in the stuff I did. So anyway, why don't you just kind of explain that, what's going on there?
Yeah, and I know you'll get to it later. And I saw it was one of your Twitter questions, one of the Twitter questions as well. So I think that is like the classic view, is that the way that you increase mitochondrial function is by having more mitochondria. So that there's like almost like a one-to-one relationship there, that if you increase, if you double your mitochondrial content, you're going to double your mitochondrial function. And I guess what we've seen is that you can disassociate those things to a certain extent. And, Yeah, we're not the first to show that. There's other, you know, when we went back and saw our findings and went back to the literature, others have shown that that as well. And so, as I said, what we've seen is with the lower volumes of or the lower intensities, the increase in content tends to be greater than the increase in function. And with the very high intensities, the sprint interval training, the increase in function is proportionally greater than the increase in content.
And why do you think that is?
I'd love to know.
Is this your hydrogen ion stuff? I was going to get to this later on, but, you know, I know you've done stuff with hydrogen ions affecting mitochondria, you know, high acidity, so high hydrogen ions kind of messing up the mitochondria potentially. Is it something to do with that or?
Honestly, yeah, you know, I know that, you know, a lot of the discussion, we're going to talk more of like some, maybe some practical implications, but as a, you know, university egghead, I'm really interested, you know, really interested in that question is what is it that's causing these disproportional increases in function? And we don't know. When we look down at the protein level as well, so we're doing some proteomics, we see the same thing, that the fold changes at the mitochondrial proteins seems to relate to the total volume of training. So that seems to increase and be related to the mitochondrial biogenesis and the content there. But for reasons that I don't know, and, you know, maybe someone listening will give us some clues, but with the very high intensity exercise, we're getting improvements in function that are disproportionately greater than the increase in the content of mitochondrial proteins and also in the total amount of mitochondria.
Yeah, and I wonder, again, there was a Twitter question. I've got to scroll down my notes here to see who it was. They were saying, is part of this maybe noise or the way you're normalizing the mitochondria? So I do tend to get mechanistic. So people that just want to know what's your bottom line and what should I do, you know, on the running track this afternoon. I do, as you know, get quite fired up about mechanisms and things. Is part of it maybe the way you're normalizing things? So, you know, the old classic about, you know, do you divide your mitochondrial function by your citrate synthase activity or mitochondrial DNA? And I actually had Russ Heppel, just spoke with him, and he had another, it was a calcium-related protein he was dividing by. Is part of it the noise or is it real? And the other thing, I just worried I'll forget, is you're measuring mitochondrial function at rest, you know, like in resting muscle that's maybe it's been exercised, but it's just sitting there. How does that relate to, you know, dynamic? So if you're looking at, you know, muscle resonant MRI.
The MRI, yeah.
Yeah, so if you're looking at the turnover there where it's sort of dynamic, you know, does that, you know what I mean? Do they fit?
Yeah, I think it's a really good question. And I mean, because a lot of the time, as you know, where you're doing indirect measures and making assumptions. And yeah, you know, when you think about the mitochondria consist of, and nobody really knows exactly, but something like about 1,400 different proteins. So using one protein or enzyme citrate synthase as a proxy for changes in mitochondrial content, you know, is possibly a little bit simplistic, but we have seen we've seen it, and also in other studies, is I guess when you do a more direct measure of mitochondrial content, which is using TEM, which is the electron micrograph, so you're taking images of the mitochondria and being able to estimate volume, you see there also that you see a relationship between, so the greater the increases in the exercise. So the greater the increase in exercise volume, the greater the increase in mitochondrial content. So I think it's probably not just a measurement issue. And we've also tried with the proteomics, we've tried to take the average of something like 600 or 700 mitochondrial proteins, and we still see the same sort of relationship. So I think, yeah, it doesn't really matter how you measure it. We're still seeing the similar relationship between exercise volume and changes in mitochondrial content.
All right, great. Yeah, so I'm kind of drilling down on this because partly, as I said, I was unaware of this somehow. So sorry if I haven't read your, because you had a classic review, you know, where you looked at with Cesare, right?
Exactly, yeah. With Cesare, so he was the lead author, yep.
Yeah, so looked at the, you know, the volume versus the intensity and, you know, correlations and things. And it was, yeah, but I just didn't pick up on this dissociation, so I'm just going to keep going on it, sorry.
Yeah, go for it.
The other thing was, like I touched on, it always frustrated me because I wanted to know what effect is exercise having on mitochondrial function. But you know, you do the exercise, you take the biopsy, and then you know, you tease out the fibers, and then you put them in there. It's like, hang on, we're sort of 2 hours later, and everything's sort of getting washed away, you know, from the metabolites and things, and then you're looking at the function. I wonder if, well, that's kind of a separate issue. I've often wondered about can you get an idea of what's actually happening in the muscle by, I don't know, changing, you know, what's in the medium. So, you know, you maybe put some lactate in there and some, you know, some creatine and try and mimic that. But yeah, I just wonder how much is what you measure in the mitochondrial function, you know, sort of perfectly related? And does it correlate very well with the MRI stuff? So, you know, for people that don't know, you know, when you get in this core, you know, maybe you've done your knee, for example, that they'll do an MRI and you see the knee function, but you can also look at these labeled phosphorus and get an idea of what's happening to metabolism. So people get in there and do calf contractions and then look at the resynthesis of the creatine phosphate, and that gives you an idea of the mitochondrial function. Do these things correlate well?
There are some studies showing some correlations, but I think also, I mean, I've never done the NMR work, so it's tricky to comment on that. But I think to your point, and maybe, you know, in some respects it's a little bit closer, but I mean, as you said there, you're still not looking at the mitochondria while you're contracting. Like you said, you're looking at the phosphocreatine recovery kinetics. So that's occurring during the recovery. So yeah, it's maybe a little bit closer than you know, when you're taking muscle out of the, you know, muscle biopsy, you're taking the muscle out and then measuring it. But I think it's also quite indirect because I guess, you know, we know that phosphocreatine resynthesis is an aerobic process. And I guess the assumption there is that the rate of the phosphocreatine resynthesis is directly proportional to the mitochondrial function. I don't know if anyone's actually, drilled down in that assumption. Uh-huh.
I agree. It actually reminds me of, you know, the classic thing where, oh, you want to see how fit you are, so you look at your recovery of a heart rate, you know, and you think, hang on a minute, that's, you know, like what's happening during the exercise is very different to like how quickly your heart rate goes down when you stop, you know, and all the variables involved with that. It's sort of a similar thing. But do they correlate though? I mean, I know you haven't done it, but if you look at the mitochondrial function, you know, in your Ouroboros and all that stuff, does it correlate, do you know, with the MRI or the NMR stuff? Or
the NMR.
Are people sort of in the different camps and they're not really looking at both?
I haven't looked at that literature for a while, but there are a couple of studies I think that have done both. And yeah, they seem to correlate, maybe not, maybe not, definitely not perfectly, but enough of a correlation to suggest that they're measuring something similar.
All right, cool. So what do we do? What do we take away? It's taken me a while to get, some people are probably like, okay, but what do I do? Like, you know, tomorrow afternoon or whatever. And we talked off air about, you know, morning or afternoon, you know, and I want to talk about that a bit later about, you know, how it's, you can get caught up on all, oh, should I be exercising in the morning or the afternoon? Or should I be trying to increase my mitochondrial function or my mitochondrial volume? And so what would you actually say, you know, to people? So I guess it gets to the point that you said earlier, which is there's more to performance than mitochondrial function and volume. But, you know, maybe just explain that a bit because it's probably a bit hard to get your head around.
Yeah, and I think, you know, having, you know, listened to some of the podcasts, which I enjoyed, the previous ones, I think it does fit in with, you know, polarized or the pyramidal type training. You know, nobody does one type of training, or I don't think anyone does, unless they're doing studies in our, you know, in exercise science studies. But, you know, most people will do a mixture of training, types of training. And, you know, Michael Joyner talked about it as well, you know, the different ways. And if I was to take a sort of a mitocentric view, kind of makes sense to me. Like I always imagine it like the nutrition, you know, the nutrition pyramid,
mm-hmm.
where like mm-hmm. you wouldn't just eat proteins or just eat carbohydrates. And
mm-hmm.
I think it's the same thing. Like you, I don't think you would just do zone one or zone two or zone three. And if we do take a mitocentric view, I think what we've seen is that those, the different volumes and intensities have different mitochondrial adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
So I think hitting those different zones makes sense to me to get different adaptations that when you put it together will improve the endurance performance. Okay.
That's true. So putting it together then with what you said earlier. So during the really high intensity stuff, you'll get a greater improvement in your mitochondrial function. And during the long, slow sort of stuff, you'll get a greater increase in your mitochondrial volume. So you're saying if you do both, which makes sense, then you get both. Now, I'm assuming people have actually looked at that. So have they compared? Now, I guess it's hard to compare because you, how do you match the, you know, the intensity and the volume? But have people done that? So they've done the really high intensity, the really long stuff, and then a combination, and look and seen that you actually get, you know, your best bang for the buck by doing the mixture.
I don't think anyone, I haven't really seen it. And, you know, most studies, you know, just because you're trying to control things, like they tend, you know, the classic stuff, and we've done this, where you might have three or four training sessions a week where it's, you know, all moderate intensity in one group, and then the other group's doing all high intensity, and, you know, Marty Gabala's work as well. And then you're sort of comparing the two. But we're actually, because I keep getting this question, we're doing that study at the moment. So what we've, you know, we've done previously, we've done, and so we've got this data that we can then compare as well, where we've done moderate intensity, we've done high intensity interval training, and we've done sprint interval training. And at the moment, we've got a, you know, almost finishing a big training study where we've got people doing all of that in a mm-hmm. week. So they're doing a couple of moderate intensity training sessions, a high intensity training session, and a sprint interval training session. And so hopefully, mm-hmm. because it's all done in our, so we've got other groups, so it's all done in our lab with the same measures, et cetera, mm-hmm. we'll be able to compare 8 weeks of moderate intensity training, 8 weeks of HIIT, 8 weeks of sprint interval training, and 8 weeks of mixing it together and seeing if, you know, that does make sense, that you're getting the kind of the different adaptations from the different types of training. And if you put that together, does that give us a, you know, an optimal adaptation in terms of the mitochondria?
There you go. So this will be good for, I mean, I know it's kind of short term compared to the, you know, training for years and years, but this will be good for the, you mentioned Michael Joyner. So if people haven't seen that one, I just thought it's a classic where he's got, you know, you talk about all roads lead to Rome, but he actually said all roads lead to Tokyo, because the Tokyo 5000 in 1964, you know, I think the winner was just doing intervals pretty much twice a day, every day. And the second, I can't remember, second or third was doing like long, slow distance, and the third was doing a mixture. So it'd be interesting to see that. And it also makes me think, I guess, about how the markers that you measure, and I saw you mentioned, you had a, there was a point counterpoint thing, and you mentioned this, and I was really happy to see it, that the markers you measure don't necessarily relate to outcomes. So, you know, a classic one is, we mentioned earlier, you mentioned protein. So muscle protein synthesis, you know, you might have, you know, you have this protein or that protein and this timing or that timing, and you get a greater protein synthesis rate, but it doesn't necessarily result in more muscle down the track. And the same with, I have to admit, I put my hand up and say, I used to do this, and it probably kind of makes sense with, because I was a bit ignorant earlier. You know, you could have measured PTC1 alpha, which is, you know, the master regulator of mitochondrial biogenesis. And if it was higher or lower or whatever, you'd say, oh, okay, so therefore mitochondria, but you can't assume that. Do you want to just flesh that out a little bit?
Exactly.
Can you assume these things? Yeah.
And I think, you know, I can't remember if it was Benjamin Miller who mentioned it as well, but I think, you know, even, you know, and hopefully this isn't too technical, but, you know, I think, you know, the PGC1 alpha is a classic because it's, you know, as you said, the master regulator of mitochondrial biogenesis. And if you go to, you know, Spiegelman's classic studies, mm-hmm. he's doing the knockout of the protein, mm-hmm. and, you know, talking about the effects on mitochondrial biogenesis. But then you do studies where they might do a single exercise session and they're changing the mRNA of it. And then assuming,
exactly.
I mean, you can't even assume that the changes in the mRNA are reflective of the change in the protein.
Which they used to always assume that, but yeah, you can't. And the time course and all that.
Yeah, a lot of it gets sort of used interchangeably. So I think it's really hard for people who aren't, you know, experts in the field, but I think it's a really good point. We just need to be really careful of what we measure. And I think, you know, one of the things I try and do with my students is not to use like the global terms, like say, oh, we saw an increase in mitochondrial biogenesis. Okay, we saw an increase in what did you actually measure? You know,
exactly.
So instead of, sometimes you can use, and it's probably for simplistically, so the paper doesn't end up being, you know, 100 pages long, but I think, yeah, we need to be really precise with what we're measuring and what it actually means.
That's true. And I was just thinking in my own defense, putting myself down there, I realized that we did actually try and do that because we would measure PGC1 alpha message and protein, but then we'd also measure cytochrome oxidase, message, protein, and activity, you know, so you're trying to get a bit more. But I guess the next step then is to actually say, well, what's happening to the performance? So in that study where you're doing the four different groups, I'm assuming you'd be looking at, you know, the signaling and the mitochondrial function. But I'm assuming also, maybe not, you'll be looking at, you know, is their performance improved more? Is their VO2 max, et cetera? Is that right?
We'll be looking at thresholds and their VO2 max. And I guess in some ways, as you'd know, we normally have a performance measure, but also I guess that, you know, the VO2 max test itself is in some respects a performance measure you can look at in terms of on how long they're able to continue the test. So yeah, that's what we try and do is kind of, yeah, signaling to mRNA, to protein, to the enzyme
exactly.
function, the mitochondrial function, and then the performance. And yeah, and I think, you know, some of, you know, bring up some of your work to related to this, but I think, you know, the cool stuff you did with the AMP activity and the phospho-AMPK, because I think that's a classic as well where people go, oh, we saw an increase in AMPK activity. And you're going, well, not really. You saw an increase in phosphorylation, which is not a bad proxy of AMPK activity. So I think, yeah, as scientists, we just need to be a little bit careful in being very specific about what we're measuring.
Exactly right. Now, I'm glad you actually mentioned just then VO2 max, lactate threshold, et cetera, because that was actually something I was thinking about. So when you say there's more to the mitochondria, is it worth just talking a little bit so people understand that? And again, I think Michael Joyner was heavily involved in this, saying, okay, what determines your running performance? Is it your VO2 max? Is your lactate threshold? Is your running economy? Now, I'm wondering how each of those is affected by the mitochondria. It's a bit of a tricky one because, you know, we know, for example, that it seems like VO2 max is more, you know, oxygen delivery, cardiac output, and there may be like almost like an excess mitochondria. You know, some of those old studies would sort of say, you know, the mitochondria is more related to performance than VO2 max and all that sort of stuff. I wonder if you can just sort of talk around that.
Yeah, and I think that makes sense. We've got some data, and I think others do as well, and we haven't actually published some of this, but I think, you know, what I always say is to people, you know, you've only got one heart, so that if you're running or doing arm cranking or whatever you're doing, you're going to be using your heart and stressing your heart and getting those adaptations, which are important for VO2 max. But the lactate threshold is mostly a peripheral adaptation. So that's reflecting what's happening in the muscles. So like if I was run training, I'd see an increase in the VO2 max if I did an arm cranking type task. But if I did run training, I'm not going to see an increase in my lactate threshold measured doing an arm crank. So the lactate thresholds, it's pretty much not 100%, but mostly confined to the actual muscles that are being trained. And I think a large part of that does reflect the mitochondria. And we have seen correlations between the lactate threshold and different measures of mitochondrial function. And I think, you know, as you mentioned, like some of Eddie Coyle's really cool work showing that, you know, the lactate threshold is quite an important determinant of performance. So I think that might be where the mitochondria is coming into the performance equation.
Yeah, I think it makes perfect sense because the classic, I think it's Shogard, 1988, showed they looked at Tour de France cyclists across the whole season and their VO2 max was basically didn't change. I think it was only, that's the other thing could be worth talking about. We can't go through everything. Their VO2 max, I think, was only 71 or 72 or something. It wasn't even overly high. But during the year, what changed, you know, like with, you know, the preseason and during, you know, Tour de France and whatever, was their mitochondrial enzymes change like 200 or 300% up and down. So, but it's the lactate threshold and the mitochondrial sort of function that's and volume that would be affecting that. Are you hearing me all right? It just says I'm unstable.
There was a little pause there, but now we're back.
Okay, all right. Yeah, so that fits. There wasn't really a question in there, but
I think that's where Eddie Coyle's got that really nice. I can't remember the exact bit where, you know, where he took a bunch of cycles. I mean, it's the 80s. I can't remember the exact year now, but, you know, had the cyclists that had similarly high VO2 max, but then he separated them into a low lactate threshold and a high lactate threshold group.
Classic. Eddie and Andy Coggan as well.
They're both on that. Yeah. And so, and he showed quite clearly, you know, the high lactate threshold group outperformed the low lactate threshold group when they had the same VO2 max. So,
yeah, they chew through their glycogen quicker and all that. I just thought a funny thing because I've had Eddie Coyle and Andy Coggan on. You'll hate that. Eddie Coyle, I hate this. Once, because I always saw Coggan and Coyle and Coggan. And just because you said, oh, yeah, he was on that. I didn't know who was the student because I hadn't met them. And Eddie was not very happy about that. So Andy was the student and Eddie was the supervisor. All right. So I'm thinking about, we're getting through a fair bit of, hopefully people are staying with us. I keep thinking about being practical and what this means for people. So what does this mean for people so far, do you think? And we'll do a takeaway message at the end.
Yeah, we can do one in the middle and the end. But I think the, I said, and sort of tying into, I think it's some consistent messages coming out that, yeah, in terms of, you know, developing mitochondrial content, then I think the, you know, I'm fairly convinced that the volume of training is really important. And so I think that fits in nicely with Stephen, you know, what Stephen was saying. And I think he made a good point. You know, some people talking about polarized or whether it's pyramidal. Yeah, I think that's a different discussion. But either one, whether you're going polarized or pyramidal, I think that there's an argument that a large volume of training is an important component of endurance training. And as I said right at the beginning, it's not going to be the only reason, but that does tie in with a large volume of training seems to be important to develop your mitochondrial content.
Yes, indeed. Now, there was a question on Twitter about someone saying, okay, well, why not do both? You know, why not just do a high volume and high intensity? And I guess, you know, you start thinking about overtraining, but it reminds me of that. Remember that study you did when I, you know, when I was still on deck, I'm sort of, you know, I'm still an emeritus professor there, but I don't sort of come in very often, where you tried to actually overtrain people and see, you know, assuming it would mess up their mitochondria and you couldn't. It was actually really, you know, you doubled the training and everything and they just got better.
Yeah. And I think that was some of Cesare's, on that. I think there's a couple of things there. I think there are a couple of things that are going on there. So I think one thing is that there's kind of this argument about, you know, whether it's an overtraining or an energy deficit that leads to some of these problems. And so one of the things that we did in that study is that we made sure they got at least 10 grams and most of them got more 10 grams of carbohydrate per kilogram per day. So they were training really hard, but we wanted to avoid that, you know, energy deficit and also a decrease in their muscle glycogen. So that may be contributed. And I think also, you know, they were like, you know, moderately trained, I think, you know, 45, 50 mils per kg per VO2 max. It seems, you know, from my reading, like the overtraining seemed to be like an accumulation of fatigue. Yes, yes. And so I think those participants, they didn't have the, you know, the training background to be overtraining. But like I said, I mean, we tried super hard. We had them doing high intensity interval training twice a day, so morning and afternoon, 7 days a week for around about 3 weeks. And we were thinking we'd stop after 2 weeks when they overtrained, but yeah, they just kept getting better and better. And so we just pulled the pin at 3 weeks. But we saw, you know, and the guys, you know, they're all guys in the study, they were absolutely wrecked. I mean, they'd sleep in the lab between training sessions. So it was, it was full on, but yeah, we couldn't overtrain them. And we had massive increases in their mitochondrial content and their mitochondrial function, mostly because, you know, it was high intensity interval training, but that also meant that they did a very high volume of training as well.
Yeah, I wonder if it's almost like a fight or flight thing that, you know, your body just responds. Well, first of all, it's amazing what the body can actually adapt to, right? So, you know, we tend to think that was surprising, wasn't it, that they could actually, so the body can respond, but maybe it's almost like a fight or flight thing where you can keep it up for 3 weeks or something, but then, you know, you get sick or, you know, something would happen.
Yeah, no one was asking for us to continue the study at the end of that 3 weeks.
Fair enough. Now, the other thing I think about, I guess, is actually it's a bit selfish because I'm thinking about myself and it's going to sound like I'm showing off a bit, but I just wonder if people need to think about whether they should tailor their training based on their physiology. So basically when I was a distance runner, my VO2 max was like 78 or something. But,
nice.
You know, it was higher than these like Tour de France. Well, they're on the bike I was running. But the point is I wasn't, you know, it wasn't like I was, world record holder or something. You know, I think Kipchoge, even some of these guys that are like 71, 72. What I'm getting at is, should I then, this is a practical thing, if I was back there now, should I go, oh, okay, I've got a VO2 max of 78. So I shouldn't worry about doing sort of VO2 max type training. I should really, you know, work on intensity or, you know, or do you know what I mean? Like should people tailor their results to their physiology? Or it almost sounds silly in a way. I mean, obviously you should, but I never thought like that for some reason. I didn't go, oh, my VO2 max is 78, therefore I shouldn't worry about maybe as much volume, for example.
No, I mean, I think that's where, there is a place for some of this physiological testing. And I've seen that as well where, you know, I've seen athletes do a lot of high-intensity training and they have really good VO2 max, but they can have quite a low, you know, relatively low lactate threshold.
Exactly.
And I think that's because they're missing some of that training volume by just focusing on intensity. So I think that, you know, comes back to the same thing. You know, it's not volume versus intensity, but yeah, if there is too much if there's too much high intensity or too much volume, you're probably not going to be getting the optimal adaptations. And I think in your instance, and knowing that, you know, you've got the VO2 max, running economy, and the lactate threshold, it's going to be hard to increase your VO2 max much above that. So looking at training to try and increase the lactate threshold or the economy would be, if you can find a time machine, that's what I'd be telling
exactly.
Young Glenn McConnell.
Yes. I'm still pretty young, but I feel like I am. But now I look in the mirror. So it's interesting. It's David Costell, who I did my master's with, and he was on also on the podcast. He used to say, if you've got 70 mils per kilogram, that's enough, and you don't have to worry about, you know, like you can basically be, you know, he used to talk, this is how long ago it was, we're talking about like people like Frank Shorter and things like this, you know, winning Boston marathons and things at 70. You can do whatever you need to do at 70, and then it's other things you need to work on, I guess.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a magic. I don't know what the magic number is, but I think VO2 max seems to be like your entry ticket. Like, you're probably not going to win too many Olympic marathons, you know, with a 45 or, you know, mils per kg VO2 max, even if your lactate threshold, you know, 95% or whatever,
exactly,
you can get it up to. But you need to be held to have have that high. And I think the VO2 max is also, that's going to, you know, that limits how high you can put your lactate threshold as well.
Exactly. But, and I remember the classic, again, it's in the kind of old days, but Steve Prefontaine had a VO2 max of like 83. And Frank Short had a VO2 max of 72, but they were both about the same speed because Steve Prefontaine couldn't hold as high a lactate threshold and Frank Short was right near his VO2 max, that sort of thing. Now, that brings me to another point. Sorry, people, that I just don't know who asked what questions and I haven't scrolled on my phone. But this thing about how it seems like if you've got a high VO2 max, you don't have a high running economy, that sort of concept where they seem to interchange there. Do you have any idea what's going on? Is that something mysterious going on in the mitochondria or is it?
I haven't seen too much link. And they could be related, but I think it actually goes to a little bit to the previous. I mean, I think there's two things there. I think that might have been, I can't remember what it was, but I think Greg Atkinson made a really good point about the being careful of spurious correlations and what that for people don't may not be aware, but if you've got what's on your x-axis and your y-axis have got the same unit. So if you've got VO2 max in mils per kilogram,
that's true,
and and economy in mils per kilogram on the axis, there's a good chance they're going to appear correlated by chance. So I think that's part of it. But the other part is I think that if economy is related to mitochondria, then the volume of training is going to be really important. And whereas, if the VO2 max is more associated with the intensity, then that would make sense to me that if you spend too much time focusing on high intensity and boosting your VO2 max, you might not have the volume of low to moderate intensity training to develop the running economy.
Yeah, and it's interesting how you said it may just be a spurious sort of correlation because I know it was actually Baz Boren, I think it is, that sent the tweet. He was quoting a paper that said that maybe what it is that when you have a high oxygen consumption, you have a lot of reactive oxygen species and they can mess up the mitochondrial function and maybe make you less efficient or something. But then Russ Heppel, who is on the will be on the last the next will be on before just before you, he made the point, which is correct, that the reactive oxygen species are not really produced by the mitochondria during exercise. It looks like it's been produced, more at NADPH oxidase on the muscle membrane, for example. So they don't necessarily fit anyway. So I guess that's the jury maybe still out on that. But I don't know. I haven't really looked into it, to be honest.
Yeah, and I think I think lots of things are to me kind of coming together. But to me, I think that does come back to the whatever the magic, if there is a magic percentage, but that at least for endurance athletes, I think a lot of this does support the importance of the getting a high volume of training.
Volume. Actually, it reminds me now. So when I had Andy Jones on, he mentioned because we talked about how did Kipchoge run under 2 hours, and he had done a study with a whole bunch of the pacers and Kipchoge, and looked at their VO2 max, lactate threshold, and running economy, and it did seem like they didn't all sort of, what you want ideally, obviously, is high VO2 max, a high lactate threshold, and a high running economy. But he found he wouldn't tell me which one was Eliud Kipchoge, but he found that no one really had the right, they didn't go. But then again, it doesn't mean one's inhibiting the other or whatever.
And I remember Andy had that paper with Paula as well. So the British female marathon runner.
Mm.
And I think Paula Radcliffe, yeah. So her best performances, her VO2 max was a little bit lower than her wasn't her peak, but it corresponded when her lactate threshold was at its highest. So I think it makes sense with anything, isn't it? That it's really hard to develop everything to its maximum, and I think that the type of training that best develops your VO2 max is probably going to be different to the type of training that best develops your lactate threshold or your economy.
It's kind of interesting. It reminds me a bit of the max heart rate. So some people may not realize, but endurance athletes tend to have a lower max heart rate. Now you tend to think everything's bigger and better, but this range. So imagine if you have. And again, if you've got someone that's got a really low resting heart rate, that indicates they've got a very big stroke volume at rest. then they probably don't have a high max heart rate. But, you know, if you have both, if you have a low resting heart rate and a high maximum heart rate, then obviously you can get a huge cardiac output. But do you tend to find that is that the people that have low, I don't know if you've looked at it, but, you know, it kind of makes sense that if you've got a low resting, you've probably got a low max as well, because you're just shifting so much blood per beat that you couldn't sort of go up to 205 beats per minute.
Yeah, we don't look at that much in the research, but it definitely, you know, when I was in previous life, you know, working more with athletes, you definitely, you know, we used to do physiological tests on them regularly. You'd see that during a season that the max heart rate would, you know, would drop mm. as they started increasing the amount of training.
Yeah, and I'm sure their resting heart rate would have gone down as well, because, you know, that's the kind of indicator of how you're going with training quite often. Now, I wanted to get back to your hydrogen ion stuff. So that was stuff you were doing when I was there. Well, it's kind of weird because I'm still there. I'm an emeritus professor, but when I was coming in every day. So that was interesting, and I found it a bit surprising, actually. So I think you were finding that if you had high hydrogen ions, so you're giving ammonium, why don't you tell us, versus sodium bicarbonate.
Yeah, do you know, there's probably a few things going on there. So it was interesting. I was working with this coach, and she just said to me one day, she said that lactic acid destroys the mitochondria. I'm going, well, never heard about that. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you know, this discussion, you know, sometimes coaches say the, you know, right things for the wrong reasons, and sometimes the wrong things for as well. But so we looked at that, and we've done a bunch of so I couldn't find any evidence to support that, but we've done a few studies where we've given sodium bicarbonate during training. We did some with rats and also with humans, and what we found was that even when people do exactly that, so doing two groups doing exactly the same amount of training, the group that's taken sodium bicarbonate, we've seen better endurance adaptation. So in humans, we've seen better increases in lactate threshold and performance, but without any differences in VO2 max. And in rats, we've seen greater improvements in mitochondrial function. So I guess we're working on this idea that potentially by, I don't know exactly how it's working, but there's something about the sodium bicarbonate that might be promoting adaptations to training, specifically in the mitochondria. And initially, we probably thought it might have been something to do with the hydrogen ions, because I guess that's what, you know, sodium bicarbonate is, you know, most famous for, is buffering the hydrogen ions. But what you also see with sodium bicarbonate, it allows more lactate, allows a greater glycolysis and more lactate. And, you know, George Brooks has done some interesting stuff showing that lactate can be also like a molecular signal. So we don't know exactly the mechanisms, but it could be that it could even be that the greater lactate during training might be contributing to the greater mitochondrial adaptations.
So even though we tend to think, you know, I mean, people are thinking it a bit less now, but, you know, this lactate is a baddie and it's messing things up. I guess we've known for quite a while that, you know, lactate's important, that, you know, it can go into the blood and be taken up by the liver and converted to glucose and be taken up by adjacent muscle fibers and oxidized and all sorts of things. But you're saying that with the bicarbonate, you're able to actually have more anaerobic glycolysis, producing more lactate, and that may actually have a beneficial effect.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of the classic kind of guilt by association, because people talk about lactic acid. Mm-hmm. And really what's happening during exercise is that you've got both lactate and the acid, the hydrogen ions, being produced. And so the sodium bicarbonate is helping to buffer the hydrogen ions. So the sodium bicarbonate gets into the blood, lowers the pH, and that acts like a bit of a sink, and that drags the hydrogen ions out of the muscle into the blood, where it combines with the bicarbonate, and then you get carbon dioxide and it gets breathed off. So not only is it removing the hydrogen ions, but it's also allowing greater anaerobic glycolysis to occur in the muscle as well. So it's difficult to tease out, you know, what might be the, where the benefits might be coming from.
Okay, that's interesting work. Now the other thing I've thought about is when we talk about, you know, all roads leading to Rome, and if you do, you know, high intensity, mainly high intensity or mainly low intensity, the thing that I tend to think about is, what about specificity? So, you know, if, so I know that Michael Joyner was essentially saying, I think, that if you did, you know, mainly just low intensity or mainly high intensity, you'd end up with similar adaptations. And I think you've sort of nuanced that a little bit there with what we've been talking about. But, you know, what about the specificity? So surely, to goodness, even if you had the same VO2 max, somehow the same lactate threshold, the same economy, isn't it important, you know, the old specificity that we always talk about, you know, training, you know, at race pace, for example, or, you know, trying to actually think, you know, if you're an 800 meter runner versus 1500 meter runner versus a 10K runner, sometimes you could almost be forgiven for thinking they could all do the same thing, you know, because they end up with the same, similar VO2 max and similar this and similar that. But surely the specificity has to come into it.
I think there's an element of that. And, you know, I think, you know, the caveat is, you know, most of my stuff is, you know, in the laboratory, and I'm not working day to day with athletes. But I think sometimes the specificity is overrated. And what I mean by that is, you know, I look at, you know, the approach I generally take is, what is the physiology that's required for that particular athlete? Mm-hmm. And then, what is the training that I need to do to develop the develop the physiology that's going to give me the ultimate performance? And, you know, I remember when I you know, was working with rowers and kayakers, you know, so something like, you know, rowers, you know, might be, you know, around about 8 minutes flat out, and, you know, they almost fall out of the boat at the end of it, because it's pretty hard to go all out for 8 minutes. But very little of their training is at that intensity. You know, most of their training is at a much lower intensity. And I think that's because that's what needs to be done to get the adaptations that are needed to perform their sport. And I think the same thing, yeah, to me, it doesn't make a lot of sense. For example, like if you're a marathon runner, to do lots of running at marathon pace, because I think that's, yeah, there's an argument for doing it every now and again, but I don't think necessarily doing your event is going to give you the adaptations that are going to allow you to excel at your event, if that makes sense. Mm. And yeah, and I think a classic, you know, a really good example is also, I think it's funny, because in running and things like, or cycling and those sorts of events, it's kind of, there's this idea that you need to be really specific. But if you think about like resistance training, you know, sprinters, like for example, trying to improve your power, you know, lift, you know, whatever, doing a squat with squats. a few hundred kilos is not even remotely similar to what you, or even, you know, a lot of the other, you know, the cleans or any of those sorts of things, but it's very different to, you know, what you're going to do in your actual event. But the point of that training is to develop your muscle and your strength and your power that's going to allow you to run fast. And I think it's the same thing with a lot of the endurance adaptations. Okay. I mean, obviously, you know, if you're talking about 800 or 1500, there's tactical, and so you need to do races to improve that. But I think I've said this, maybe I'm going around in circles, but I think the argument for doing most of your training at race pace, I don't think there's really any good evidence for that.
Oh, yeah. You wouldn't suggest that. I guess I was thinking more, I'll tell you what I was thinking. So when I was a distance runner, I would do my intervals, and it feels like there's been a bit of a move away from this, but, you know, I would do my intervals just slightly faster than my race pace, you know? So, you know, don't have to give, I always give an example of much slower than I was, so it doesn't sound like I'm showing off. So just say you're a 5 minutes per K runner.
Yeah.
You know, I'd I'd suggest people do their intervals at, I don't know, four minutes 40 per K, you know, not crazy, you know, because I remember I'd go down and do interval training. Some people would be just tearing around the track doing their 400s, smashing me. And I'd be doing, you know, slower, you know, slightly faster than race pace, and then a short recovery. That's the sort of thing I mean, you know, rather than, because these people would kill themselves in training, and then you get to the race on the weekend, and it'd be the opposite. You know, I beat them sort of thing. And so I guess the point there was you do some of your training, you know, so like easy day Monday, intervals Tuesday, long run, you know, Wednesday, whatever. But you're not just tearing around the track like a galoot. So I guess this is what I'm getting at. When I did my undergrad, it was always like, if you're doing intervals, you do sort of like, you know, 1 to 3. So the work interval 1, and then 3 to 5 for the recovery, if you're like, you know, a sprinter or something. And then if you're an endurance type, you do 1 to 1. And I remember even you would know the name, you know, the Australian Steve Monaghetti, he would do 1 to 1/2, you know. So if he ran 3 minutes at his interval, then he'd do 1.5 minutes recovery. And to me, that makes sense. But it feels nowadays with more and more sort of sprint interval training, high intensity interval training, that's a lot of that's sort of gone out the window. I don't know if the textbooks have been updated or not, but, you know, you know what I mean? Like, remember it used to be really sort of structured, and it's like, oh no, you're training for a 5 or 10K, you do 1 to 1 or 1 to 1/2. You're training for this, you do 1 to 2, whatever. It seems like it's almost like the all roads lead to Rome thing. You mix it up and you'll end up getting there anyway.
Yeah, and I think we've definitely, you know, I've seen exactly what you're talking about. You know, when I was working with kayak athletes, you'd quite often see at the beginning of the season, you know, we'd be trying to do some, you know, maybe some training just below or just above the lactate threshold. But you'd see sometimes like the athletes who weren't as fit would try and keep up with the fitter athletes.
Mm-hmm.
And so they weren't training at their programmed intensity. And the beginning of the season, they'd be fine. You know, they think they're smashing it. I'm keeping up with all the better athletes. But, you know, when you got to the end of the season, inevitably the better athletes, but who are training at their intensity, would get larger improvements than the athletes who weren't as fit, but who were trying to keep up with the better athletes, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
so,
right. Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, it comes back. I think it's about training. I think it's about trying to train the physiology that you need to perform in that event. And, you know, some of the examples you've seen, like we've seen like a 2 to 1 for the intervals works really well for developing muscle buffer capacity, whereas we'll use more like a 1 to 1 when we're trying to develop the mitochondrial adaptations, for example. So I think, you know, probably, you know, what you're describing is not necessarily wrong, is that, but people were doing those different interval ratios to get different adaptations, which might be more or less important depending on the actual performance outcome that was desired.
That's true. Yep. Okay. Now, do you need to go, or
I've got another 5 or 10 minutes, mate. Yeah, if you want to wrap it up. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Okay. Good man. Okay. So Angelo asked, this is quite interesting. He said at European College of Sports Science, he kept trying to ask you this question. You were running around getting pulled in 10 directions at once. So we can ask it now while I've got you pinned down. He said, if he understands your talk correctly, you presented data showing that high intensity exercise elicits autophagy of mitochondria, which is also called mitophagy. So maybe you can explain what that is. And essentially the biogenesis of new and improved mitochondria. Do you think this is a key mechanism in explaining exercise-related improvements in metabolic disease?
Yeah, I'm not sure about metabolic disease, but so that I was presenting, I can't remember if you were around, but that was Javier Botella's, some of his PhD data. And
yeah,
he had some really cool findings, which were trying to write up at the moment. But basically, we compared low to moderate intensity continuous exercise. So we did that for about 90 to 120 minutes with sprint interval exercise, so classic 30 seconds all out and repeating that 4 to 6 times. And we took some muscle biopsies directly after the first training session. And we did some of this transmission electron microscopy where we can get really precise images of the mitochondria. And what we saw was that only after the sprint interval training We saw around about 15 to 20% of the mitochondria were damaged, and some of them quite severely damaged. Like you just see, the classic bean-shaped mitochondria with the cristae in them. We saw some that were just completely hollow. They just had the outer membrane and there was absolutely no cristae. So that was just after the four sprint intervals. And I know that, some people kind of freaking out going, oh, no, sprint interval training is damaging your mitochondria. But, most exercise is a stress. And the whole point of exercise is to stress, and then you adapt to the stress so that it doesn't become as stressful next time that you do it. And so we also did a bunch of other measures showing that this mitochondrial stress response was being activated with sprint interval training. So what we think is that when you're doing this very high intensity exercise is that it's speeding up the natural recycling. So mitochondria are continually being built up and broken down over time, and we think it might be speeding it up. And I was talking on another podcast, and the presenter came up with the great term, out with the old, in with the new. So we actually think that one of the benefits of this really high intensity, so sprint interval training, is that you're getting mitochondria that are maybe on their way out, and you're sort of kicking them out the door a little bit quicker, and they're getting replaced with better, newer, better functioning mitochondria. And so we think that might be why we're getting this disproportionate improvement in mitochondrial function with the very high intensity training.
Okay. So that fits with that. Well, that's interesting. Okay. That's good. All right. Now, just earlier you said there may be value in people having tests. And it was one of my questions is, you could, sometimes when you look at Twitter and things, people are saying, oh, you got to know your zone one, your zone two, and you got to know your maximum fat oxidation. You've got to know your VO2 max. You got to know your lactate threshold. You got to know your economy. And I can imagine some people maybe with maybe a few too many dollars hanging around, but other people, scraping together whatever dollars they have to go and have all these tests and things done. What do you think about that? Should people be running out to sort of get their exact physiology, or should we think about, hang on, the Kenyans used to do pretty well back in the 70s and 80s and the Ethiopians without all these tests? It's a bit of a leading question. I think I've given you my opinion.
Yeah. But I think it's like everything. I don't think there's a right or a wrong, but I think, like you said, especially if we go with the idea that the volume of training is important, you probably don't need it. I mean, there's not a precise intensity there. There's going to be a range of when you're in that moderate intensity training. I think when you're getting into the other zones, there can be value. And I think sometimes also, like you were saying, being able to monitor your adaptations and being able to see, okay, this season I did this type of training, I got really good improvements in VO2 max, but my lactate threshold didn't change, or vice versa. So I think it's also being able to monitor and see how you're training, if it is progressing how you want. And I think also, a lot of these things, depending on, finances, like you can get a pretty good idea even, by running around a field. Exactly. There's lots of precise tests for a lactate threshold or maximal lactate steady state, but I think most runners or cyclists know that intensity where it's hard, but if you go a little bit quicker, you're not going to be going much longer.
Mm-hmm.
So
exactly.
And you don't need to be training, at the 0.1 k an hour. It's not that precise, but if you did that sort of train, exercise yourself, you'd be able to know, okay, my lactate threshold is around about 15 k's an hour, 16 k's an hour, whatever it might be. And that could help you to know, okay, this is where I need to, if I want to stay below the lactate threshold, if I want to do some intervals above the lactate threshold, it may help just to guide that type of training.
Yeah, and you get a bit of feel the more training you've done. And is it fair to say that, quite a lot of people just aren't doing enough training, and that maybe they're thinking, oh, I can get this sort of, boost by if I know exactly what my lactate threshold is and my zone, you know, my what zone this is and that. When really they could just be training more, maybe, and more consistently and for longer, you know, like putting years and years together rather than sort of this tinkering around the edges. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty fair. And I think, you know, there's quite often, you know, you can, you know, a lot of people will buy new equipment, try some different nutrition, and or go and get some expensive tests. And I mean, I think you're spot on. You know, maybe the starting point is, you know, getting the increasing the volume of training and the consistency of training and having a, you know, having a regular habit. They're probably that's where I'd be making the change before I start getting the wallet out.
And along the same lines, I mean, on Twitter, Nanette asked, you know, do we complicate training zones and intensity? And I guess that was a lot of the discussion with Andy Coggan and Stephen Seeler and I've suddenly forgotten someone. You know, do we need to worry about, oh, you know, is this zone two or zone one? Because there's a lot of stuff on Twitter about, you can almost think, you know, if you're not in zone two, the world's going to come to an end, or your mitochondria is going to blow up or something, or you'll never be able to burn fat again. You know, because as soon as you go too intense, it inhibits fat oxidation. And, you know, so Andy spoke quite a lot about that. He doesn't really believe that, you know, that he did a study, you go, and, you know, during the one exercise, you go intense and you use more carbohydrate, less fat, and then it goes down again when you drop, you know, and then up again. It's not like as soon as you go intense, you know, your fat, you won't burn any fat.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it probably relates a little bit to your previous point. I think it's, taking the long-term picture. So I think one, you know, sometimes, you know, people talk about this just in terms of the next training session, but where I actually think it's more useful is where, you know, you can get to the end of the season or the end of the year and go, oh, look, this year I did most of my training in zone one, or in, you know, I did this percentage in zone two or zone three, and I had my worst result or my best result, and that then helps you to modify it for the next season. So I think, you know, using it as a guide and also as a way of evaluating either a training block or a training season, I think there is value. I think, you know, if you think about the markers, so the metabolic thresholds which define those training intensities, I think there's definitely differences in metabolism that are happening in those zones. Mm-hmm. And I think there's presumably some differences in signaling and adaptation. So I do think there are different adaptations that will occur in those different training zones. And it can be used as a guide, and, you know, individuals can then adjust it based on their results.
Okay, just so to sum up, I guess I'm wondering, I'd like to do a takeaway messages thing at the end, but just even before that, to sum up, and I guess it is sort of takeaway messages, I get the feeling you are almost like an 80-20 sort of guy, maybe not, you know, the exact percentages, but, you know, you feel like you're doing your 80% low intensity, so you're getting your volume, yeah, and then you might be doing your 20% high, getting your more function, and then, as you've said, also there's more to life than the mitochondria, but other things will sort of flow from that. So is it fair to say that you are sort of in that camp, perhaps?
I think, yeah, the volume is definitely important, and I think the one of the things that we didn't touch on really, but I think also like the a bit like you're saying, like the VO2 max, I think that you can't dissociate volume and intensity completely. And I think, you know, to give an extreme example, like if you walked for 8 hours at a really slow pace, like you could get a pretty good volume of training out of that.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. But I don't think you're going to get great adaptations out of that sort of training. So I think there's definitely I don't want to say threshold, but I guess it's like medicines as well, where you have like a minimum effective dose. I think there is a minimum effective intensity. And I mentioned Javier's study, and we did a very high volume of training just below the first metabolic threshold at about 85-90% of the metabolic threshold. And we saw some pretty good improvements, but not as great as what we've seen when we've done training above the first metabolic threshold, so in zone two. So I tend to think that that's probably where I'd be, that's where I would be doing my volume training, is in zone two, so above the first metabolic threshold.
Kind of low zone, because I mean, these things are so wide. That's why, as you say, there are seven. I think even once someone had eight. Andy Coggan, I think it's seven. But, you know,
at least
it's
seven,
such a
yeah.
Wide thing, right? So I think it's a low zone two. Is that what you're saying? So if you're, and when you say first metabolic threshold, you're talking about the first lactate threshold, yeah?
Yeah, I say metabolic threshold just because, you know, some people will use ventilation as, you know, use the first ventilatory threshold or foot. But yeah, just the first lactate threshold, the same thing. So where, I guess where there's a first change in metabolism. So, yeah. That can be where you start to get the an increase in lactate above resting. It can be where there's an inflection in ventilation as well. So that okay. point where there's a clear change in metabolism. So first metabolic threshold, first lactate threshold.
Yeah.
Bottom of zone two, that seems to be, you know, somewhere in zone two. I think that's probably where I would be doing my volume training. And then, like you said earlier, still adding in some high-intensity interval training. So that's going to be, you know, above the second lactate threshold or second metabolic threshold. Mm-hmm. And I think also, you know, there's an argument, and going back to your previous point, even though it's not very specific, also having some sprint interval training. You know, there's not, you know, apart from maybe a 300-meter runner or something, you're not too many events where you go all out for 30 seconds. But we've seen some very specific mitochondrial adaptations with that type of intensity as well.
And it's interesting also because bringing up Andy Coggan again, I remember years and years ago, he was a top time trialist. And he used to do 30-second sprints. And this is before Marty Gabala had – and I know even before Marty Gabala, there was people that were doing the really high-intensity stuff. And I was like, what are you doing? And or even like 10 seconds. And he said it was more for like sort of neuromuscular adaptation, you know, and I guess teaching yourself to really sprint. But he was a cyclist, and obviously they have different needs that we've been sort of focusing on running. But, yeah, it's interesting. It's sort of come full circle in a way that, you know, I don't think he was thinking about the mitochondria back then. It was more explosive power and maybe neuromuscular, you know, sending messages to the muscles to contract and, you know, even strength. You know, like almost like a specific strength training. But yeah, it's interesting. You're finding the mitochondrial function can be improved with that.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, maybe that does sort of bring us to the take-home message. I think, you know, one of the things I say quite often is that, yeah, I'd be looking at, you know, what is the physiology that's needed? And, you know, we're physiologists, so that's what we focus on, but there's other things as well. But, you know, in this case, what's the physiology that I need to perform at my best, and then designing the training that's going to develop that physiology,
exactly. Mm-hmm.
Rather than necessarily thinking, you know, how am I going to, you know, do specific training? And you see that sometimes, you know, you're talking about the Twitter sphere, et cetera, where, you know, people put a lot of effort into trying to do training that really closely replicates what they're doing in their event or on the sporting field. And yeah, I'm not convinced that that's the best way to go.
And yeah, it comes back to the physiology, because I remember teaching people about carbohydrate use during exercise, carbohydrate loading, carbohydrate ingestion, and you'd say, okay, so do you think carbohydrate loading to increase your glycogen is going to improve a 30-second sprint or a 3-minute effort? And they said, well, just think about it. Are you going to use up all your glycogen in that time? No. Well, it probably doesn't then. You know, and same with, is carbohydrate ingestion going to improve performance? Well, your glucose levels stay fine for about the first hour of exercise, whether you drink carbohydrate or not. So therefore, it's probably later when it starts to drop that it's going to have the improvement. So you just come back to the physiology, right? And then it, it helps to inform what you're going to do.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's a little bit off topic, but I remember, you know, when I was first started teaching, there used to be this idea that you needed to train dehydrated to improve your ability to run because you're going to be dehydrated. And, you know, I mean, maybe superficially it kind of makes sense. But then all the research came out and said, no, well, you need to, you need to hydrate, you need to increase your plasma volume. Training fully hydrated, you're going to get better adaptations out of training. So I think, like I said, it's a little bit maybe off topic, but I think that's a good example of, you know, training exactly as you're competing isn't going to necessarily lead to the best adaptations.
That's true. Well, thank you very much for going much longer than, I think your watch is going slow or something down there. Maybe it's down. I can make down under jokes because I'm in Copenhagen. But can we just do some quick takeaway messages from this chat, if that's okay?
Yeah, sure. So I think the number one is what we were just saying there about, you know, train your physiology. So have a look at the event that or what you're interested in doing. What's the physiology that's required for you to excel at that event? And then design your training to target that physiology. In terms of mitochondria, maybe all roads don't lead to Tokyo. So we have seen that the mitochondria respond to different types of training. So the sort of the moderate intensity, high volume training, we tend to see disproportionate increases in mitochondrial content compared to the mitochondrial respiration. High intensity interval training, we see a more of a proportional, so the increase in mitochondrial respiration is quite similar to the increase in mitochondrial content. And then when you go to the very high intensity, so like sprint interval training, we'll see that the increases in mitochondrial function are disproportionate to the increases in mitochondria. And I think when that comes then to the, I guess, supporting the periodization, pyramidal training, putting it all together. Yeah, I think that's why, yeah, and I don't have the magic mix there, but that's where I think getting the high volume of training, but also introducing some high intensity interval training and sprint interval training is probably going to lead to the best mitochondrial adaptations.
Okay. And I meant to ask you this earlier, but how much are we talking about? Is it 10%? So, you know, when you say that really high intensity, you get more disproportionate function versus volume, et cetera. Are we talking about sort of 10%? Are we talking about 50%? I mean, how much are we talking about differences there, like in terms of not matching up?
Yeah, I don't know if I've got the exact number. So what we do is, and you'd be familiar with some of this, where we measure changes in mitochondrial respiration, and we'll report those values. But then we can also, we'll divide by the changes in mitochondrial content. So we have like a mitochondrial respiration per mitochondria. It's not exactly per mitochondria, but per amount of mitochondria. And we're not the only ones, but what you can see is with the high volume, moderate intensity training, you'll see a decrease in the mitochondrial respiration per mitochondria.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Whereas when we look at the sprint interval training, we'll see an increase there. So yeah, I'll have to put that on my homework.
That's fine. Yeah.
List, but it's a bit probably of a about tricky, 10 or 20%, though, I'd say.
It's a tricky one, because I had this conversation with someone else, and it's something I've always thought about. Is, you know, when you divide something out, you can kind of miss. So, you know, you talked about AMPK phosphorylation and things earlier. We had these sort of conversations. So I'll just try and explain to you. So just say you do an endurance training study, and the person's left ventricle increases double, for example. But they've also had a doubling of their citrate synthase. So their mitochondrial but then when you divide it out, you go, oh, there's no real change. You know, because if you talk about mitochondrial per milligram of heart, for example, you divide it out and you go, oh, there's no change. It's like, well, hang on a minute. Surely it's good to have double the left ventricle volume, and within that left ventricle to have double the mitochondria as well. But when you divide it out, you lose it. So I'm sure you've had these sort of thoughts about, you know, And it fits again with a Fleming dealer found that people with diabetes have less mitochondrial function. It's just because they have less mitochondria. There's the same function per mitochondria. So that sort of dividing out business, you could kind of lose your message.
And I think that's where, I think that's right, where you need to be, just be really clear with the message. Because I think, ultimately, if you think about it in terms of training, you want to have the greatest mitochondrial function probably per the amount of muscle. So like your body doesn't really care if it's per mitochondria. It's ultimately you want the, maybe a bit like VO2 max as well. You know, what you're looking for is, you could go and, lose some body fat and improve your VO2 max in terms of mils per kg. But on the bike, it's probably not going to help your performance. So I think ultimately what you want to be able to, the amount of energy that you can produce per milligram of muscle is going to be the decisive factor. But I think it's still interesting that the different types of training do affect mitochondrial content and mitochondrial function differently.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And I've learned that. Sounds like I should have knew that beforehand. Okay, well, thanks a lot for your time. It looks like you've gone over time as well. It's been great to chat. And I'll see you. I'll have to start coming into Victoria University more often when I'm actually back in the country as well, and I'll come and see you.
Yeah, okay. No, great. Awesome. It was really good to chat, mate, and well done on the podcast. I think it's been good to listen to.
Oh, great. Thank you very much. Okay, see you, mate.
See you, mate. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.